This is a tape interview with Mary Beth Petrosic, formerly Gregor. The date of the interview is September the 6th, 2002. The purpose of the interview is to write or get background information to write a feature article for the alumni newsletter.
Okay.
We're up and running.
Alrighty.
Mary Beth, what I want to do is, you know, we do these feature articles on our alumni, and you've certainly got an interesting background and what you're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And I had talked to Clara Vanderbilt, and she says, you know, not many people doing what Mary Beth's doing. So let's get just a little bit of background. I've got your file and some background, but you were a medical technologist right before you came into the program.
Mm-hmm.
And you entered and graduated in 1987.
I graduated. 87,
right.
Yeah, a long time ago.
Yeah. Gosh, you don't seem that long.
Oh, thank you.
Right, and as a medical technologist, what school did you go through?
I went through Penn State.
Penn State, mm-hmm. Right. And degree was in medical technology.
Yeah, medical laboratory technology.
And remind me where you worked as a medical technologist for a while.
Penn Hospital in Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you find out about PAs and how did that come about?
Actually, when I was working at West Penn, one of my closest friends, boyfriends, and soon to be her husband, was going to the PA program at Cahoga.
Right.
And I was kind of looking around at different things, and he said, well, this is a good thing to do, and told me all about it, and I said, yeah, that sounds like a great thing. I think maybe I might want to try that.
Right. And you started exploring that and found out about the programs, and you applied to a number of programs or just to Duke?
I actually applied to three, I applied to Duke, I applied to Hahnemann, and I applied to the program that at that time was at Penn State.
Right.
At that time they were having some problems, and so they weren't accepting anyone. I came to Duke for my interview. I had an interview at Hahnemann maybe a month or so after that, but had already been accepted to Duke, and had already sent my money to you guys, but I went to the interview at Hahnemann anyhow.
Okay.
I went to see some friends that lived in Philadelphia.
Okay. And then you came to Duke, and of course spent 2 years with us.
Yeah.
What was your first position after you left Duke?
I went to the surgical internship at Montefiore.
That's what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
So you went straight into that out of Duke.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Clara Vanderbilt was there with the crew. And
oh,
let's
absolutely.
See, this was in 87, so mm-hmm. they were probably had been around for 10 years or more by that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so there were some of those early graduates of that program on staff too, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was that experience like?
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I could do it now.
No.
But that was the best 15 months that I had ever spent. I learned an incredible amount.
Mm-hmm.
I worked incredibly hard and loved every minute of it. And really, it really put the finishing touches on my education that I got at Duke.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you remember how many residents there were at that time in your group?
I want to say maybe 18.
Yeah, it had grown fairly large.
Yeah, I want to say probably about 18. Maybe Clara could probably tell you
right.
A little bit better how many were there.
It was 12 months, right?
Well, it was a total of 15 months.
Oh, 15.
3 months doing a didactic type of program where
that's right.
Really spent a lot of time on surgery and the inner workings of being a health officer.
Right.
As well as, you know, what you need to know for in your medicine and that. And then it was 12 months of rotations in the general surgical and the surgical subspecialties, including ICU.
Mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough to work in the Jacoby at the burn unit.
Right.
As well, so that all was very helpful.
What was your impressions of Clara and Dr. Rosen and maybe Dr. Gleedman, I guess, was the chairman at that time?
Yeah, he was. Boy, are they smart. they were they were very pro-PA. They helped you along with anything you needed as much as they could. If you had any questions about anything, you could go to them, talk to them, and they were all excellent, excellent teachers. I mean, being in the operating room with Dr. Rosen and Dr. Gleeman was really a wonderful learning experience.
So they really treated you as first-class citizen, had a very good idea of how to use PAs with the surgeon team. And I guess held people pretty much accountable for patient care.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the first, you know, night that you're on call by yourself and you're going, and I remember being on call that one night and I was doing my first rotation and it was trauma at Jacoby, which was the trauma center.
Yeah.
And got a call from the operator who said, well, there's a patient down in the emergency room. And I said, well, I'm the intern. The second year the chief goes down to the emergency room. And she said, well, they told me to call you. I was like, oh, okay. And I went down to the emergency room and, you know, evaluated the patient with the, it was a multiple trauma type patient, so there were several other residents from different specialties there, and did the best I could and went up to the operating room and said, you guys know that you have there's a patient down in the emergency room? And they called me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, we were both busy, of course. We told them to call you.
Oh, my goodness.
So you certainly went in.
Baptized under fire.
But that's an excellent way to learn.
it was. And a very good place to learn with the public patients and being right down in Bronx, I guess.
It was a really excellent experience. I mean, my first job from there was in trauma. And I think that, you know, I went to Hurley Medical Center in Flint, Michigan.
Where was that again?
Hurley, H-U-R-L-E-Y.
H-U-R-L-E-Y Medical Center.
In Flint, Michigan.
Okay.
And was on the trauma service there. And really, there were no residents there.
Uh-huh.
And so you were it. You know, you were the first responder to the ER for all the trauma cases.
How long were you there at Hurley?
I was there about a year.
Okay, so you were 87, almost up to 88 at Montefiore, and then
And then 88 until not quite 89 at Hurley.
Okay.
I left just shy under a year because I was afforded a wonderful opportunity back at Montefiore and actually moved back to the Bronx to work with Dr. Scott Bowley and the pediatric surgery staff at Montefiore.
Now, how you spell Scott's last name?
B-O-L-E-Y.
B-O-L?
E-Y.
EY.
Yeah.
And pediatric surgery?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, and then how long did you stay there?
From about 89 to 94.
To 94,
mm-hmm.
Okay. And then from there, how did the opportunity go from there?
Well, I met a boy.
Yeah.
I met my now husband.
Yes.
Who lived in Virginia.
What's his first name?
Michael,
okay.
Mm-hmm. And decided that, you know, this was the man, so I moved down to Virginia and got a position with a group of emergency physicians called Emergency Medicine Associates.
Uh-huh.
And so I worked in the emergency room. They contracted to several hospitals here in Maryland and Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And I worked with them for about 5 years.
Did you rotate through different hospitals in Maryland,
mm-hmm.
Virginia?
Mm-hmm.
So you had to be licensed or registered in both of them?
And I still actually keep, I'm still inactive, but I do keep Virginia and Maryland, and now I have D.C. as well.
Now, were you living where you live now as far as residence in Virginia? Or?
Yes.
Okay. So you were commuting a good bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you did that for how long?
I was with EMA for 5 years.
For 5 years, so mm-hmm. That was 90.
During that time, I was actually the PA coordinator for about three of them.
PA coordinator?
Mm-hmm.
That is of other PAs in the practice?
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you doing any teaching at that time? Was anybody sending students to you?
No, we didn't. Unfortunately, we didn't have any
right.
students.
Okay. And so you did that up to about 1999?
Yeah.
Okay, and then where did you go from there?
And then in January of 2000, I started with the medical examiner's office here in D.C.
How did that come about?
Well, kind of an interesting story.
Okay.
I was working, you know, since I was out of academic, you know, I'd been out of academics for a while. You know,
yeah.
You always got all your CME because you were going to, you know, M&M and
yeah.
Ben Rounds and all that. And, you know, one day I took a look at my CME and said, oh boy, I need some more. And I was flipping through the journal of, or the annals of emergency medicine.
Uh-huh.
And there was an ad for a medical legal death investigator course in St. Louis. And I'd always had been, you know, pretty interested in that. You know, I grew up on Quincy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, never been to St. Louis, and it was a lot of credits. So
mm-hmm.
I went.
And this was in medical legal issues? Was
medical legal death.
Oh, death.
Death investigator. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, you know, I'm kind of interested in it, and what the heck?
Yeah.
So off I went to St. Louis for about a week, and met a wonderful woman who ran the course, and her name was Mary Fran Ernst. And she, I sat for a week listening to this, and the whole time thought, this is a perfect job for a PA.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely perfect. You know, we do history and physicals, but we just don't do them like you did them in the ER.
Yeah.
And all the other aspects that go with it, you know, from, you know, the forensic part, the law enforcement part, a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And said, wow, you know, this is great. And talking to her, she said that DC was hiring PAs as investigators. I was like, okay. And, you know, I kind of thought about it a while, and they had another course, a more advanced course than that following summer. So I went to that thinking, well, cause, you know, that's where all the big wigs go, so
mm-hmm.
I'll go there, and mm-hmm. maybe I'll be able to do a little networking. And when I was there, I met the director of forensic investigations here in D.C. His name is Randy Moshos, M-O-S-H-O-S.
M-O-S-H-O-S?
Mm-hmm. I met him there, and while I was there in July, we set up an interview and went for an interview in August and then got the job and started in January.
Now, that was in the office of what division was that?
It's the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner.
Office of the Chief Medical Examiner, and that is for actually the D.C., right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and what was his position?
He's the director
okay.
of forensic investigation.
Okay. Okay, and they had been hiring PAs?
Mm-hmm. When they started, they got a new chief medical examiner, and I believe it was end of 98, beginning of 99.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Jonathan Arden came from New York and brought Randy with him. And they were hiring PAs, because in New York, the only other jurisdiction that uses PAs as investigators is New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And so since they came from New York City, that was what they were used to, and they liked the idea. And they continued it down here in D.C.
So he was familiar with using PAs in New York City, so
yes.
When he came to Washington, one thing he thought was, we need to hire some PAs.
Exactly.
So he knew what the role was and all that. Now, do you have a sense of who the first PAs were in New York City? Any of that history at all?
I really don't have, I can't really say. I know Randy was one of the first, but I don't know if he was the first or not, but he was one of the first ones there.
So Randy was a PA?
He is a PA. He was in New York. And like
okay.
I don't know if he was the first, but he was certainly one of them.
Yeah, that'd be an interesting, you know, put on my hat as the historian, that'd be an interesting story to tell.
Would, and I can certainly get you in contact with Randy
sure.
about that.
Great. So you went to these courses, you learned more about it, you networked, you met Randy. Randy had come here to work in the office and as a PA. They needed more PAs, and how many folks eventually hire the PAs into the system?
We currently have 5. We need certainly more, but you know, we kind of have to wait for budgets to be approved, etc.
Yeah.
But yeah, we currently have 5.
So how many were there when you came?
When I got there were 2.
So Randy and you and...
Actually, there was Randy, who was the director, and there was another PA named Michelle Mappolito and another one named Terry Massey.
Okay, so there was 2 PAs. Randy was in the administrative part of it,
and so
you and 2 others
mm-hmm.
made up the investigators as far
mm-hmm.
as PA investigators.
Right.
What was the role description like? I mean, what... What did you bring as PAs that maybe other people trained to be investigators wouldn't necessarily have?
Medical background.
The medical background.
Medical background.
And that was the key.
Yeah.
Because you could fit right into the forensic medical side of it.
Right. You know, when we investigate deaths, a lot of times we speak to physicians. Well, almost all the time.
Yeah.
If there's a physician available, we speak to them. You know, and we were able to converse with them, you know, at a higher level that some other people might not, you know, might be unable to do.
Right.
You know, they don't have to sit there and say, well, we had to put a tube in his chest, and we, you know, we had to open his chest. They can just say, you know, we put chest tubes in, we did a thoracotomy in the ER, you know, that kind of stuff, and we can follow what they say. And we have an idea of what they did, because most of our backgrounds are surgery,
right.
ER. Mac has, her background is actually in psychiatry and correctional medicine,
mm-hmm.
and substance abuse. So, you know, she kind of, you know, she lends that to the group when we have questions. We're always bouncing things back and forth. Some of our other investigators
right.
that we have now, one was an OBGYN. So we're always bouncing questions back and forth to each other about, well, what do you think about this?
Or, so a lot of this was going in to talk to the patients to the physicians or
mm-hmm.
other health providers that
right.
when this person showed up at the ER, trauma, whatever, and reading their notes and files and things mm-hmm. of that nature. Right.
Right. Yeah. When someone, if there's a death in the hospital, for instance, and it falls under our jurisdiction, such as, you know, it was, you know, a traumatic type of death where they died within 24 hours of getting to the hospital, what have you, by law, the hospital has to report that death to our office. And so we speak to, you know, whoever, the physician, the nurse, the PA, the NP, whoever's calling in the case,
mm-hmm.
And we find out what happened, if they had a short, you know, if they were in the emergency room for a bit of time and they had, you know, the emergency thoracotomy and the like, or if they went to the OR, what did they do in the OR?
So is that any death or just suspicious death?
We do suspicious deaths, natural deaths that are what we call unattended.
Uh-huh.
They don't have a physician. Or their physician can't be found, you know, he's on vacation or what have
you. Right.
As they said, you know, if a traumatic death, you know, an accident, a homicide,
right.
suicide. Right,
right. Okay, so the police officer's gathering information and you're looking at it from the medical side and the
exactly.
death and what was truly the cause of death, time of death, those kinds of things to make
right.
sure.
Right,
and then what was done to the patient if they were still alive when they arrived.
Exactly,
or, yeah.
exactly. Because one of the important things that we ask, especially if it was, you know, a gunshot wound, did you remove any projectiles? Because we need to be able to tell the pathologist who's going to do
right.
autopsy what was done so that they can look at the wound and then look at the surgical, you know, the surgical procedure or the anatomy that might have been changed from the surgical procedure or what have you.
Okay, so if the patient's sent to the morgue then for additional investigation.
Right, if it's a medical examiner's case, what we call accept jurisdiction,
mm-hmm.
Then they go, our technicians go to the hospital, pick the person up from the hospital and bring them to our office.
Yeah, okay. How many cases would you be involved in a week normally as a PA? I don't know if you do these in pairs or...
No, we do them, right now we do them, you know, we each have our own cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can have, you know, maybe 40 cases a week. I mean, that's a very rough estimate.
Jeepers.
You know, it just depends because we do, you know, we take the information, you know, we get the reports from the hospitals, but we also are... We also, part of our job is going to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's, you know, we can start, one of the best things about this job is you walk in the door,
and you never know.
For your 12-hour shift, and you have no idea what's going to happen.
So you're on 12-hour shifts?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And, I mean, you can get in the door and be told there's a homicide, you know, pick up your bag, get in the
right.
and go. Be at that scene and get a call from one of the investigators in the office saying, you know, there's someone who just died naturally in their home, but they don't have a doctor.
Right.
And off you go to there, and then, you know, you might end up your day getting a ride in a boat from the Harbor Patrol to go get someone that's, you know, been found along the Potomac somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I guess people turn up that's been missing for a while, and
yeah,
and you got that.
Right. And with the police, we try to get them identified. We try to get next of kin notified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still do the same things that PAs in the ER and the clinic do. I mean, we still deal with families. You know, our responsibility is the person who's died.
Right.
We're responsible for them. We're responsible to them and for them, and we're responsible to their families. to make sure that, you know, these people are treated with as much dignity as we can
sure.
give them.
Okay.
So treat them like they're members of our own family.
Oh, very, very important.
Now, as if I can quote my friend Mac, who said, you know, sometimes, you know, remembering that we work in D.C., where people, if anyone's ever been to D.C. and has seen, you know, the homeless and what have you, people can come to D.C. and if they want to be lost, you know, if they want to get
yeah.
lost and, you know, be out of touch with their families, they can really do it. And sometimes people come to us and, as I said, I'd like to quote Mac, you know, the only respect they get is whenever they are, you know, they're brought to the morgue and we're dealing with them and they're dead.
Now, you're saying you're quoting Mac?
Yeah, my colleague Mac.
Okay, okay.
You know, we have to, you know, if we can't find their relatives, or if we do find their relatives and for whatever reason their relatives are unable to bury them,
mm-hmm.
Then it's the city's responsibility to do
right.
that, you know, the district's responsibility to do that. And
yeah.
we make sure we have a protocol that we follow for folks like that, and make sure that we do our best to get them identified, whether it be by family members or by
mm-hmm.
x-rays or fingerprints or what have you. So at the very least, they have their name on their death certificate.
Yeah, so the idea is get a name with
mm-hmm.
the body, and if any family, make sure they're notified
right.
and
if
they're handled in a respective way.
Right, and if they can't, you know, the district will bury them.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we do that I think is really important, and we try very hard, we have a really good working relationship with the VA,
mm-hmm.
the VA Medical Center here. And if we have someone that we know is a veteran, we can get them buried at one of the at Quantico, which is one of the local VA, you know, military cemeteries here in the district.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's real important.
That's,
that,
yeah.
that they get a little extra treatment. You know, they get buried someplace where. You know,
well, it sounds like you get to use your personal. Communication skills a good bit in this job too.
Oh yeah.
You don't lose that as a PA doing this
oh,
job.
Oh, not at
yeah.
all. And
yeah.
you know, it's, we have to, you know, a lot of times we, as I said, we're dealing with families when they're going through probably the worst thing of their lives.
Yeah.
You know, they've lost a sibling or a mother
mm-hmm.
or a father.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly a rough time for them.
The quickest you can turn around a case, I guess, if nothing, I mean, if everything looks appropriate and not suspicious and all that, you close out a case within the day, or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
We do. If
okay,
you know.
And then others might go months.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, they might go months.
Testifying in court?
We do have that responsibility. That is one of our responsibilities. We, being new here in the, you know, being new to the legal system in the district,
yes.
They haven't called us very often to testify.
So they go more with the medical examiner or
right.
coroner or
mm-hmm.
forensic doctor or whatever.
Right. They'll call the medical examiner. They'll call the detective. There are rare occasions that we do that. One of, you know, somebody would get called. Not terribly often, but that may change as, you know, the U.S. attorney gets used to us being here. You know, because we've only been here about 4 years, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
You know, they've only been here since Dr. Arden started. So, everybody's still kind of getting used to it.
How do you feel all these other players that are involved, from the police, legal, forensic, the whole group? Do you think your group is viewed and held in pretty much high esteem, or how do you?
Definitely by the physicians that we work with.
Right.
The doctors, the physicians, you know, the pathologists.
They couldn't do it all, nor could the city afford them, I guess, if
yeah.
they had
the, Yeah, the physicians we work with, you know, the pathologists we work with, the physicians we talk with, the law enforcement, you know, they're getting used to us, and they
mm-hmm.
and we have a pretty good working relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
And because we deal with jurisdictions not only in D.C., which there are many, law enforcement, you know, there's not just the Metropolitan
mm-hmm.
Police Department, you know, there's the Capitol Police and the Transit Police and a whole bunch of other ones. But we also deal with jurisdictions outside, such as the various surrounding counties here
mm-hmm.
in the Maryland and Virginia area. So we deal with them and, you know, the fire investigators and,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's just a whole lot of different jurisdictions we deal with in any one day.
Do you carry a badge, or do you just have
a
card?
An ID.
An ID card.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds exciting. If I put you on the just saying, if you could list the three or four major things about your job that you really like, what would those three or four things be?
The variety that I see every day, the variety of circumstances I can find myself in any day,
right,
given day. The medicine that I learn, it's a constant learning experience. Dealing with the people, mm-hmm, the families,
yeah.
I find that very rewarding.
Right.
I mean, I've been to places where, you know, it was a natural death. The person just died at home, you know.
Right.
And the family's usually there. And I've had, you know, the mother or the grandmother give me a hug on the way out the door and thank me for, you know, being so understanding and, you know,
yeah,
compassionate.
And they have a million questions to ask.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Let's see, that was three.
No, I'm saying they have a million questions to ask you.
And I make sure that I take the time to answer them because
right,
they might not get them answered any other time.
Okay, variety, learning experience, working with families.
And working with the people that I work with.
Yeah.
They're all it's a very good group of people that I work with.
Right. Is there any drawbacks to the job? Other than long shifts?
Long shifts don't really bother me.
Yeah, and do you rotate those shifts?
Right now we are 8 a.m. to 8 p.m.
Okay.
When we get more people, we will be 24 hours.
Okay.
But we still, like, the things that come in through the night, we investigate them the next day, so.
Gotcha.
What did you say now?
Well, I'm saying, was there any drawbacks to the job, or?
No, not really. There are times whenever it's hard.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some cases will really tug at your heartstrings.
Yeah.
I can imagine
children especially.
Yeah, children especially, right. They'll really tug at your heartstrings.
Yeah.
Sometimes, I can't even say that sometimes you're out in the cold, sometimes you're out in the heat, sometimes you're out in the snow, sometimes you're out in the rain.
Yeah.
That's not really a drawback. That's just something that, you know, is part of the job.
Yeah, it's not that you're in just sitting in an office all day. You got your theater of activity moves around a lot.
Yes, it does.
And
it's
run
all over the city.
Yeah.
You know, from the waterfront on up to, you know, the subway stations. it's everywhere.
Uh-huh. Is there any organization for you guys who are PAs that do this kind of work? Have you thought about an organization?
Yeah, we actually have.
Okay.
We have thought about it, and we don't have anything organized. We've spoken to some of the PAs in New York,
mm-hmm,
and we've kind of started, like, looking at a database just to kind of get little information about everybody.
Yeah.
And we've been working at that, but, you know, as you probably know, it's kind of hard to do, especially whenever, you know, you've got a lot of work to do on your own.
And as far as you know, is it just New York City and D.C. that have PAs?
D.C. and I believe Nassau and Suffolk County, too, have PAs.
Okay.
But they're, you know, right outside of New York.
Right. For your small group of individuals.
We are a very small group of individuals.
Would you encourage PAs to investigate the possibility of going into this?
Yeah, I would. And we do take students. We get PA students, we get medical students, we get some pathology residents every now and then from some of the different hospitals here in D.C. And I do encourage them to look into it. It certainly takes a certain kind of person because sometimes things that you see, you have to look at things in a way where, how do I want to put this? It takes a special person because sometimes you don't see such nice
yeah,
parts of life.
Yeah.
And you have to keep in mind that, you know, this person has died and he or she can't speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's your responsibility to be their advocate, if you will.
I got you.
Yeah, so, you know, unfortunately, people don't die, you know, peacefully in their bed.
I assume, though, that a PA that wanted to do this sort of actually go out and practice a while or go through a postgraduate course.
We make sure that if we're going to hire someone, they have to have, I believe they need to have at least 1 year of experience,
mm-hmm,
doing whatever they're going to do,
right,
whatever their thing was, emergency medicine or surgery or you know, internal medicine or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We do, they do have to have some experience before they can come on board.
Okay. Anything else to add to that? I think I've got, you know, good quotes and good information that would go fit into an article very well. If not, I'd like to drop back just a little bit to your experience here at Duke and some of your memories about that. I remember those 80s and moving into the 90s. It wasn't as crazy of years as the 70s, but a lot of things were already on the horizon about, you know, change of health care and the growing AIDS problem and just a lot going on. How did you feel about your classmates? You got here, what was your general impression of Duke and your classmates?
I was impressed from the time I walked into my interview,
yeah.
To be honest with you. And I was very impressed with the type of people that you picked to be in the class. You know, all types of different folks from all types of different backgrounds. And I was very impressed that, you know, I know you had however many applicants you had at the time, and that you seemed to pick the right people. You had a, I know you'd been in the business quite some time, but you had an inner sense of who would be good, who would be successful, who would do well, you know, and the way that you chose your candidates was very, I thought, incredible. When I got there, you know, I was from Pennsylvania and didn't do a lot of traveling, and was meeting people from all over the country.
Yeah.
And learning different things about where people were from.
So the fact the program wasn't regional per se,
no,
attracted people from everywhere, with various backgrounds. Very good strength, I guess, both from a growing experience, but also from a learning opportunity to learn from each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was the program what you expected, more or less about what you expected?
More in what I learned. I mean, it was certainly very, very challenging, and I felt very challenged then, and it was a good learning experience for me. I thought that, you know, everything that, I did my best to soak up everything you were able to give me, and hoped that would, you know, take me on to other things.
Right, now you went to school in, was it the Allied Health Building, or were we back over at Duke by that time?
We had classes over in Duke North in that auditorium.
That's right.
So the
hospital, new hospital, hadn't been built too long.
Mm-hmm, no.
Yeah, but we were up there in the amphitheaters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, the amphitheater.
Get a nosebleed if on the back row.
Yeah, I tried to sit in the middle.
Yeah. Anything stand out about the clinical year? Any particular rotation or preceptor that you recall?
Oh, when I went to NCB.
NCB.
When I went to North Central Bronx for the ER rotation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty wild rotation.
Yeah.
I mean, I hit the door with my bags and, you know, went into the surgical part of the ER and looked at the attending and said, "Hi, I'm your PA from Duke." And they said, "Do you know how to suture?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, put your bags down underneath the desk and get to work."
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We used to call it the war zone.
Yeah. That was a wonderful experience. I thought that was one of the better rotations.
Did that start you thinking about emergency medicine, trauma medicine?
Yeah. That and actually the surgical rotation that we did at Duke. That was a real good rotation, too.
I've heard a lot of graduates say they feel a big plus at Duke was the fact it wasn't all medicine, and the surgery components, both didactic and the second year were
yeah,
certainly
strong. Yeah, I think the surgery part, the dog lab, that really got me thinking into surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And then going to NCB and meeting Clara, and that made me start thinking surgery even more.
Right.
That was probably, I think, probably one of the standout rotations that I took that made me kind of go on the path that I did.
As far as your classmates, again, just a good heterogeneous group of people. You still keep in touch with many of them?
I try. Uh-huh. You know, we're also spread out, you know?
Yeah.
But we do try, and I, you know, give them a call every now and then, whoever I can.
Yeah.
You know, but it's kind of hard to keep up with everybody.
Right. And I know you married. Any children or?
Yes, No.
Yeah, I was thinking not, but I wanted to ask because I didn't. If I write an article, don't want to leave anyone out and bring people up to date. Any advice to our new wave of PAs as their students and start thinking about careers and being PAs in healthcare?
Yeah, I guess I have to think of something good and profound, as I know.
Well, not really.
I just think that to take every day and know that you're going to learn something, and that's something you may not think is important that very day, but somewhere along the line, you're going to use it, or you're going to say, oh yeah, I remember learning that. When I was at Hurley, we also had students there.
Yeah.
And from my experiences of Montefiore and learning different things and learning clinical things that you don't learn in school, from being on the floors and going to see the person who's complaining of chest pain at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
I remember we had a lady who was complaining of indigestion and hiccups, and I got an EKG on her, and sure enough, she was having an MI.
Yeah.
And I had told the student, hey, even if you don't think that the patients don't read the book, like we like to say, something like that, get an EKG, it's not going to hurt. And I told her that, and she came back to me a year later. I saw her at a meeting or something, and she said, I had this lady, and she had she had these symptoms, and I remember what she said, and she said, I got an EKG, and sure enough, she was having an MI. So, things that, even the littlest thing that somebody tells you, if you can try to keep it in the back of your mind, someday it might help you.
And that's the beauty of not learning everything from a textbook or online. It's those pearls, those clinical pearls that get dropped to you either in lecture or out there in the wards when people are presenting and discussing things.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's the key, whenever you take every little thing that you can and make it into a learning experience, because you never know.
Right.
Someday, you're gonna need it.
Well, I think I know the answer to this, but would you do it all over again?
Yeah. Yeah, but it might be a toss-up between cooking school and PA school.
Oh, really?
I've become quite an accomplished cook since I left PA.
Oh, is that right?
That's my stress relief.
Yeah.
If it was a particular, usually working 12-hour shifts, we work, maybe 2 days in a row and maybe have 2 days off. And if it's been a particularly stressful couple days, God knows what my husband will come home for dinner.
Love to experiment? Is he pretty good about eating your experimental foods?
Yeah, he is pretty good about eating. Like, I know the things he won't eat, so I try to stay away from
him. Well, that's good. I know some husbands are just...
And have them eat the stuff he won't.
Yeah, I know some husbands are picky and just meat and potato kind of guys,
So. Well, he was, but I'm kind of
expanded
his taste buds a bit.
Okay. So, love of cooking. Any other hobbies or things you're involved in?
Cooking, reading, I must say, this job isn't as glamorous as CSI, but I still tend to read the mysteries and tend to read some of the books and say, that's interesting.
I don't watch a lot of TV other than, and I don't watch a lot of the sitcom things or the others, but isn't there a new series out kindly on clinical investigation or?
Yeah, CSI is one, and there was one called Crossing Jordan. And to be honest with you, I've never sat and watched the whole thing of any of either one of them.
Yeah, but I remember Quincy, Dr. Quincy. I remember that he was, an examiner. It was kind of interesting. I had forgotten about that.
Yeah. So, and that's who I grew up with.
So reading mysteries, you still like that problem solving mysteries, and that fits right in with your job too. So I guess that's
because a lot of times it is a puzzle, and one question will lead to another question, will lead to another question. Mm-hmm. And when we go to scenes, we examine the body. I don't have a stethoscope around my neck anymore. But, I look at them for signs of, at the person for signs of trauma, for signs of chronic disease. And then if it's wherever the scene, quote unquote, happens to be, whether it's, an abandoned lot or a park or someone's apartment or home, You know, you look around for medications that might help you either with a doctor's name or a, you know, or give you an idea of what the medications are.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
when the police call and say they're at a scene and this person has this medication, and this medication, you can figure out what their medical history is just by that,
mm-hmm.
You know, to a degree. You might not get the finer points that they had, you know, a particular surgical procedure or something, but, you know, you get an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we look around, when we look around the scene, you know, if it's, you know, is are there remnants of, shall we say, illegal substances? Are they, if they're diabetic, have they been, does it look like they've been taking their insulin or their oral hypoglycemic? You know, even what kind of food's in their refrigerator, you know?
Yeah.
Do they look like they're eating? Do they look like, you know, they're eating the right things? You know, what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, yeah, I mean, I see what you're getting at. You really try to get a sense for this person, their socioeconomic, what was their medical past. Does that give you any clues to other people you might call or hospitals check on, pharmacy records?
Yeah,
it just goes
time,
on and on, yeah.
Actually, I had a woman one time that was had been dead in her apartment for quite a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to, and her house was... her house was a bit cluttered, and I was able through, I don't even know how I did it, but as I was leaving the apartment, I found a card for a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
I called the dentist, and sure enough, she was a patient of his. Unfortunately, he didn't have any dental records, any dental x-rays to identify her. She had just gone to him to fill a tooth or something. But through him, I was able to track down a doctor who was able to tell me where this lady had some x-rays. I was able to track down those x-rays and get her positively identified.
Oh, that's great.
And, I mean, and that was really,
mm-hmm.
that's really the challenge when you have this little piece of information and you're able to track back.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes you might, you know, you wake up in the middle and might go, oh, you know what, tomorrow I got to remember to call this particular
mm-hmm.
group of people, and maybe they can help me, because we deal a lot with the homeless outreach folks here in the district.
Right.
A lot of times they're very instrumental in helping us find, mm-hmm. identify people and find next of kin in some respects,
right.
In some circumstances. We also have a group of people called, it's a group of called Recover, they're grief counselors,
mm-hmm.
who have a place called the William Wendt Center for Grief and Loss here in the district, and they come to our office and they help people with identifications, and they help them with
mm-hmm.
You know, any questions that they need and, you know, that they might have, and then we work with them as well, because, you know,
mm-hmm.
we might have to go in and talk to the families as well.
Well, it sounds like you do a lot of networking with a lot of different social, civic,
yeah.
other groups, church, I guess, too. Or
yeah, whatever. Yeah. A lot of times people, you know, from the church will come forward to identify people for us
mm-hmm.
and say, we know they have family here, we know
mm-hmm.
they have family there, and through the police they can, you know,
mm-hmm.
we can sometimes find them.
Well, it really does sound, although it's not the typical clinical role, it sounds like it has a lot of the same characteristics of that you would want to bring community resources to bear upon the
mm-hmm.
problems you have or what you see.
And, and like I said, you know, we do histories and physicals. We just don't do them the way we used to.
Yeah. Yeah.
We don't carry stethoscopes. We carry cameras.
Yeah.
And thermometers and, you know, things like that help us
mm-hmm.
When we're looking at, you know, when we're examining someone at the scene.
Right, right. Well, it sounds like exciting work, and I can see your dedication to it, and I see the fun in it, as you said, making sure these people have a respected and burial, and there's an advocate for them, especially if something's not right in their death. And but I understand, too, that you're working in an environment like social workers and police officers, and some days you just see the worst of humanity and not the best. And
mm-hmm.
But I guess there are occasions where you see that, too, people reaching out to
people. There are days that, and sometimes when you're talking to the families, you know, they're upset because, you know, their mom died or what have you. But if you let them talk, and
mm-hmm.
they talk about their mother or their father, their sister or their brother, and you just give them a chance, they will tell you stories. And by the end of the conversation, you have a feeling that you know, they were a pleasure to talk to.
Yeah.
And, you know, you kind of give them a little outlet, and they talk. And sometimes, you know, you mm-hmm. even say, oh, I know what you mean, you know.
Yeah.
My aunt so-and-so was like that, and I understand, you know. Mm-hmm. That, you know, she didn't always tell you what was wrong with her.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, we hear that all the time, and don't
right.
think that you're alone in that.
Yeah.
Because people feel bad, you know, geez.
I should have picked up on this. I should have been over there that night or whatever.
Exactly. Geez, if I would have called her yesterday
mm-hmm.
instead of today,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe things would have been
yeah,
different.
That guilt feeling. Yeah.
And I mean, and I actually, you know, I try to make sure with even physicians, when I speak to them, I offer my sympathy to them at the loss of their patient.
Right.
Because some docs have been, you know, taking care of these folks for, you
yeah.
know, 20 years.
Yeah.
And they know, you know, when their kids got married and they, you know, where they were going on vacation and,
right.
you know, that kind of stuff. And, you know, when they lose a patient, it's can be sometimes just as hard as if it was a member of their own family.
That's true. That's
and,
true.
You know, and sometimes we got to talk to them, too.
Well, is there anything else? We've been at this about 90 minutes. So.
Oh, goodness. Well,
45 minutes. I'm
okay,
sorry.
I'm
sorry. 45 minutes. I got a 90-minute tape. It's 45 minutes each side, and it's getting low.
Okay.
I can't think of anything else. I'll write this up and send it to you, and if we think of anything else, we can add it,
okay.
whatever. And if you can get me that photograph,
I will.
I'm going to go ahead and turn this recorder off, and then we can visit a little bit.
Okay.